Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. My name's Paul Edwards and I'm in Miami, Florida. I'd like to welcome everyone to this evening's edition of Tuesday Topics. I'd like to thank Rachel and others who are recording, and I'd like to thank Chrissy and whoever else gets involved with editing, who obviously make this show far better than it might otherwise have been. And finally, of course, we'd like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities for making the software available to us, which enables us to do this show at all. Tonight, we are discussing a topic that is of interest, I think, to many people who are blind, and that is access technology training. It may on the surface seem like a slightly dry subject, but I think as we move through the topic, you'll actually find that there are a lot of pretty hard questions that we get to explore, and a lot of answers that may seem obvious that really aren't. We're very lucky this evening to have as our special guest Brian Charlson, who is not only Vice President of the Carroll Center in charge of their Access Technology Training Program, but has also been in charge of the AER group, which is responsible for access technology. He's a member of the Board of Trustees of the American Foundation for the Blind, where he has taken some particular interest in some of the access technology work that AFB has done. And Brian has also been a part of a number of task forces that have taken a look at trying to determine how best we should provide training for people who are blind in terms of using access technology. The Carroll Center as well can properly be described, I think, as the pioneer in distance learning in terms of access technology training, in that they now have a number of courses available that are ongoing, which are taught online, and that enable people who need to learn to use PC applications to learn how to use those. So, it's with great pleasure that we welcome this evening Brian Charlson to our microphones. By the way, in addition to all of these abilities, Brian is the immediate past first Vice President of the American Council of the Blind and is also currently a board member of that organization. So, Brian, where shall we start? Goodness. Well, I suppose let's start by asking you whether you think that the infrastructure that we have now is providing us with enough training available for people who access PCs and other computers who are blind. And if not, maybe you could tell us some of the directions that we need to go. So welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Paul. I guess at this point, and I've been doing this kind of work for the past 20 years, I can honestly say that there's probably more training available, but we still lack both in quantity, especially when you talk about training outside of metropolitan areas, and quality, because we continue not to have any real scheme for guaranteeing any form of quality control over access technology training.
Yep. I suppose we could start there. Quality control. Now, presumably that means finding some way to certify trainers. Couldn't they just go to school and go to college and get a degree in something and then be considered certifiable?
I did a bunch of work with the American Foundation for the Blind under a grant where we were trying to determine what qualities a good access technology trainer would have to have. Debbie Cook of Washington State did a great deal of the writing up of our activities at that time, and I'm now in possession of those documents and some beginning tutorial activities associated with creating an individual through training who is capable of having all of the qualities that we look for. I guess the answer is at this point there are a variety of programs out there in access technology, but they tend to be general in nature rather than blindness specific. The problem with taking that concept of, okay, here's a set of skills that a trainer would need to have, and say, all right, let's test for that, and whoever passes that test will be certified as an instructor. There are very, very few agencies who are at all interested in either, one, paying anything extra to cover the cost of that process, or two, are at all interested in insisting that the only individuals that they hire meet such a standard. Again, mostly price-based. And of course, there is the issue of, if you suddenly said only those individuals who are certified can be instructors, there's going to be an even greater shortage.
Okay. So we can't, for the most part, rely on going to school and getting a degree. So what steps ought we to take then to create a cadre of capable trainers?
We were looking at a variety of different ways that that kind of thing can be done, one of which is a portfolio method. This means that individuals who go, say, to Freedom Scientific and take their course in writing JAWS scripts can get a document that indicates that they've completed that course successfully. They could add that to a portfolio that would also include each of the different conferences they attend and sort of and indications of every time they presented on a topic in such a manner that it was actually worthy of being presented at one of these technology conferences. And you'd slowly build up a portfolio that, while it wouldn't be a certification, you could show to a potential employer. I would think that after a number of years of that approach, there will begin to be a bit of upward pressure, that is, to pay more for those who demonstrate this capability and less for those who do not. And then that could, in turn, change into a true university-based program for training trainers in access technology.
Without meaning to pick on Freedom Scientific, though, you mentioned it, and it sort of brought to mind one of the concerns that some of us have over current training. Agencies, and in fact even states and regions, tend to have a situation where what they train is what their trainer knows how to train in. And I guess one of my concerns is, if you're talking about someone who's going to be training in access technology, is it okay for that person, for instance, to only know how to use JAWS and MAGIC and OpenBook?
If they're hired to train on specific devices or software products, and they do it competently, I have no problem with that. The real issue of diversity of knowledge comes into play when we deal with issues of evaluation rather than training.
Do you think that a trainer can make a viable decision about what software is most appropriate or what screen reader is most appropriate in a given kind of environment if he doesn't and can't demonstrate some familiarity with more than a single screen reader?
When we were talking in the good old days about the certification process, we were saying that we might generate a certificate, and that certificate would have a series of endorsements. One might be able to claim just that you are a JAWS instructor or trainer, or just a Window Eyes instructor or trainer. Or if you knew two and could demonstrate that you knew two or more screen readers, you could get a general screen reader endorsement. And the same thing would be true for large print or screen magnifiers, for OCR technology, for Braille technology, etc., that we'd end up with a series of endorsements associated with that. If you are required to, in fact, do that for three or four products, and not only to know how to use them, but to actually have experience in doing so in a training situation, you're going to find that you're going to cull out perhaps some people who ought not to be calling themselves trainers, but you're also going to eliminate the possible use of individuals who are very good at single products, especially in an environment where there's insufficient people to train. So it's a combination of cost, it's a combination of experience, and it's also a matter of whether or not what you need is very specific training or what you need is general training.
I guess I still have a problem with that, though, because presumably an access technology trainer ought to be able to take a look at an individual who is coming into that agency or entity where the person is delivering training, do some initial evaluation of that individual, and then make some determinations about what looks like the most appropriate kind of screen reader for that individual to learn. We'll just take screen readers for now. And that decision will be based not on what he's able to train, but surely on the specific needs of the individual.
I have to go back on simply 20 years of experience. If you and I had this conversation 15 years ago, one out of four people that my agency saw would be coming in for evaluation, where there was some intent for that process to actually determine the best product for that combination of individuals' learning skills and the types of tasks that they wanted to perform utilizing the technology. The fact is today it's more like 1 in 20 that come in for evaluations. Almost entirely the people that we see, there's already been a determination that, let's do this kind of triage. You have no usable vision, and you do not know Braille, and you have not expressed an interest in some other screen reader. Therefore, we will issue you the screen reader that we have the most experience with, says the state agency. And I'm not talking about a single state agency here. I'm talking about a half a dozen different agencies that my agency deals with on a monthly, if not weekly, basis. And they will determine that you're going to get JAWS unless there's a reason for you not to use JAWS. There are other states where the reverse is also true, where there's an assumption that you're going to get window eyes unless there's a compelling reason for you not to use window eyes. This is a matter of economy of the resources that are available, but also simply a matter of triaging the nature of what you can make available and do well. If you are a Braille reader and you have usable hearing, then there might be some determination as to whether or not you should be using speech alone, Braille alone, or a combination of the two, as well as which screen reader would do best at driving the type of Braille display, not only that would work best for you, but that actually is available at this point in time. So while it would be helpful, and there is value in having a multilingual, if you will, screen reader instructor, is less valuable there in a situation where only instruction is taking place. The decision of what is to be taught and to whom it's going to be taught has already been made up the line.
Okay. And an evaluator, just to be sure that we're clear, is somebody who has the ability to act in the 5% or less of the times in order to determine what appears to be the best software for that individual.
Correct. Though again, I don't want to limit evaluation to just evaluating the individual. It's also evaluating what tool works best in combination. For example, if you were working with the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS has a contract with Freedom Scientific, so there's no evaluation involved there. There may be an evaluation in terms of how to go about teaching this individual. Some individuals might be best taught very specific processes, while other individuals would benefit from being taught the concepts behind things so that they could continue to teach themselves and or be more flexible about what products they will be able to use without further instruction. So there's certainly some evaluation that goes on, but it's not an evaluation choosing between two or more products. It's really an evaluation of how best to instruct this individual the tasks they need to perform with that product.
I guess I'm sort of dinosaur-like because I'm still stuck in this evaluation thing. One of the issues that we certainly evaluated was the degree to which an individual was computer-oriented, if you like. I guess I would hope that some sort of evaluation of that kind still goes on at the beginning to assess where an individual is and to develop and implement an individualized training model, which surely is going to be necessary if you're going to do a good job with each person.
You're a visually impaired person, relatively newly blinded, so you do not have the skills to read Braille. You have insufficient vision to use screen magnifier. You're totally blind as a result of diabetic retinopathy or something along those lines. And the rehab agency has determined that you are a good vocational client. It's worth them investing some of their limited resources, not only in buying you a product for use on the job, whether it be a current job or a potential future job, but also worth investing the time and money to get the appropriate training in the use of that product. To some degree, you're going to make some determination as the purchasing entity what skill sets you are looking for through that training operation. So you're not going to send somebody in to become a transcriptionist and expect that the trainer is going to spend any significant amount of time on email and web browsing, except for how that might impact their ability to receive and transmit their work. So, you as an instructor meet this individual after hopefully, and I underline the word hopefully, seeing some records about their past in terms of training, things like how well they type, how well they spell, their educational background, if there's been any noted issues associated with their fine motor skills, any kind of neuropsych that may have taken place that deals with how this individual processes information. You hope you have all of those in a nice little manila envelope ready for you to read before you start the process. Likelihood is not. But you hope so. So let's assume in this case you did get that kind of information. Now you meet with the individual. It's been many weeks to establish a time, a schedule where both you and that individual can get together and all of the products are in place. You've got the latest version of the product you're going to be training on, the work schedule both for the instructor and the trainee are matched, and you get started. Now, in advance, you're going to establish at least a starting point of how many hours the funding agency is going to place into that process. So while you may concern yourself with how rapidly this individual is going to learn and how thoroughly this individual is going to learn to use this combination of hardware and software, the fact is you're working with finite time. So at the beginning, you probably start by saying, I'd like to teach this individual how to fundamentally use a Windows PC or a Macintosh. So I'm going to teach according to the concepts associated with such things as title bars and menu bars and scroll bars and dialog boxes and pointers and windows, etc. But at some point during the training, you're going to have to make the decision, since the hourglass is half empty, what more you need to cover as topics, and you're going to have to move to a different style, a little bit more process-oriented and a little less concept-oriented, in order to at least significantly reach the goals established at the beginning of the training. Remember that when this training is over, another one is scheduled. That's the necessity of the business model that says that we're going to charge as little as possible for training, and therefore there can be as little empty space in a schedule as you can possibly arrange. So if this training doesn't finish in 2 weeks in terms of mastering the content, you still have to move on to the next client who has been patiently waiting their turn, and your report would probably indicate that this individual needs additional training in specific areas, and some of that training might be best done at a training center or at the workplace, college, university. Maybe it's not so good that it be done on a full-time basis. It's more important that they get more practice time. There's all of these things that play a part in that process. But the business model itself, the way things are funded, the relative availability or lack of availability of trainers in the area that you need training, both physically and subject matter, all play a part in what you're actually going to get to do. So I do think that unless we live in a universe where there's four times as much money, four times as qualified instructors, and those instructors are geographically spread out enough that everybody can get a reasonable access to it, we've got problems. And we have several others that I hope we get to later in this interview.
So let's take it to the end and look at an individual who's completed his or her training. Does the agency who's paid you for that training, or paid anybody for that training, have the right to have expectations about what that individual can do? And if that person does have that right, what sort of expectations can they have? And how do you measure completion of training?
My agency fills out two types of training reports following training. One report is a series of tables associated with the skills necessary to master different types of software. So we might have a table all about Word, and another one about Excel, and another one about PowerPoint, another one about Outlook, etc. And there's a series of skills listed there, and there's an indication of how well you did with those skills. Are you independent? Do you require some coaching? Was it only demonstrated and not taught? You try to create a record of the instructor's impression of how individuals do in these skill areas. If time did not allow you to get to Excel, and Excel was listed on the request for service as a lower priority than Word, then you might not get to Excel in the time made available to you, and you will delete that as a table, but still indicate that while Excel was a goal, time was insufficient to accomplish that, and make your best case for additional training to cover that subject. That's one type of form, and we do it with tables, and we also do it with a series of narrative comments, such as comments and recommendations, past experience, learning styles, these kinds of things that are more free-form written paragraphs on the part of the instructor. The state of Connecticut established their own form for reporting computer or access technology related training. In that, they have you outline not all the skills associated with a given task, but rather log everything that you covered and include in that a description of how much mastery the trainee had in that skill when you had to stop and move on to other things in order to give a more well-rounded training to that individual. Today I spoke with a rehab counselor who indicated that while we were advocating for this individual who they sent to us for 2 weeks worth of training slash evaluation, and I say slash evaluation because in this case it turned out that the counselor really wanted more evaluation than training, but sent them having filled out a training application. Turned out the individual only has access to a 40-minute demonstration copy of JAWS back at home, and the counselor was not at all interested in issuing a copy of the JAWS screen reader to that individual until such time as they had a job offer. I feel that's horrible. But it's a growing situation, not only in New England, but when I talk to trainers and evaluators in virtually every state of the union. So we do have issues associated with the expectation of the paying entity, whether that be the employer, the school, or the rehab agency, the training organization, whether that's a private contractor or a state agency employee or private agency employee, and the expectations of the trainee themselves. Many, many times a trainee comes in having filled out their own application and comes in wanting to know how to do such vocational tasks as burning CDs. We have no problem in teaching those because they could be useful tools to teach concepts. But we end up being in this negotiation between the payor, the payee, and the trainee and getting a reasonable balance between them.
Just to dot I's and cross T's with this one, it's all well and good to say I taught it to him, but he didn't learn it. So my question very specifically is, are there, at the end of training programs, specific tests that an individual who's received that training should be expected to pass? if there are not such tests, should there be?
All of the Caroltech online classes include testing. We have a pretest that indicates your knowledge of the subject matter prior to taking any training. A series of quizzes throughout the training that quiz your knowledge on the specific skills being taught at a given time. And a post-training test that is then compared to the pre-training test to determine what kind of improvement has occurred. And that can be broken down also into to skill sets as well. I also acknowledge, however, that there are some people who do things much better than they test for their ability to do those things. And the minute you start to quantify somebody's skills, it leaves them open for an individual who's making all kinds of decisions on their behalf. I point to rehab counselors who look at it and say, gee, you went from a 40% only to an 80%. Is that sufficient for me to be out there advocating for employment for you in the use of this product? I'm much more concerned that the individual demonstrate their ability to the instructor rather than that I test them on those abilities. But in an online environment, demonstrating requires quite a bit more back and forth and time consumption than do these short little quizzes, though all of our online classes also include some exercises.
We've talked so far almost exclusively about people who are rehab clients, that is, people who can receive funding from a state agency because of the fact that there's an expectation that they'll go to work or be self-employed. But there are three other groups that I think you could argue probably could certainly use computer training. One of those three groups are children. The second of those three groups, it seems to me, are individuals of vocational age who at this point simply don't believe in themselves enough or don't believe that they have the skill sets to actually go out to work. And then, of course, there's the largest group of all, which is those people who are not rehab clients because they are really too old for there to be a generic expectation that they're going to stay at work very long. The question with all of these groups is, how do you provide training for the non-rehab folks who falls into one of the other three categories that we just described?
The constant everyday battle. When it comes to children, it is supposed to be the part of every child's IEP that there be an access technology component of that. Some form of process by which it's determined that this child would benefit from a piece of technology and the training in its use. In the old days, and when I say the old days, I'm just prior to the current reauthorization of IDEA, you would go through this determination of whether or not a new evaluation was required each and every year, and you'd have to put in writing that it wasn't necessary if you aren't going to do it. Now, you must do it at least once, I believe, every 3 years. So can these children get access technology training? Yes. Is there sufficient trainers to train them? Absolutely not, because each of the school districts assumes that the money that they put into paying the salaries, either directly or under contract with TVIs, teachers of visually impaired, should be sufficient for them to get the access to that type of training. For that reason, while the Carroll Center is first and foremost a training center for blind and visually impaired individuals, we put a great deal of effort into training TVIs themselves so that they can carry that technology knowledge on to their students. And many times, simply because the students have already, without the benefit of a TVI training them anything, outstripped their teachers themselves. So the teachers work to try to keep up with the kids rather than so much teach them at this point. With those non-vocational clients who fall between that 18 to 65 year age span, we have a serious problem. The problem is that the money is simply not there for non-vocational purposes. Since 80 cents out of every dollar spent for rehab is a federal match for the vocational rehab system, there's a real problem in coming up with dollars to do the other. Those have to be state dollars, not federal dollars, that provide any services to those individuals. Certainly not-for-profits such as the one I work for attempt to deal with that a bit. In fact, if an individual does not qualify for general vocational rehabilitation funding of their access technology training, then my agency has a pool of funds, and we will, on a case-by-case situation, scholarship in part or in whole access technology training. Needless to say, it only goes as far as the money can stretch, and there are years where we're more likely to do that and years when we're less likely to do that, depending on the nature of our budget. When it comes to elders, what's the current figure, Paul? Something like $30 million spent by the federal government on older blind services? That doesn't stretch very far either. So we need to deal with the issues of elders in the same way, that is, the private not-for-profits end up filling the gap that state and federal government fail to fill. And we do that through a significant amount of fundraising. Though one should not assume that because you're older and you're blind, you're therefore too poor to pay for your own. The fact is that currently, when I talk to my colleagues around the country, their situation is very similar to ours at the Carroll Center. That is that less than 1% of access technology training purchased through training services of one kind or another. I don't know about any statistics that have ever been gathered on a one-on-one private contractor coming to your house to tutor you on Thursday afternoon. But the others, less than 1% is paid for by the individual. There's an expectation that the system is going to provide that to some extent. And I think there's some reasonable expectation when there's a financial need issue associated with that. We also have to keep in mind that while the training system out there is funded for VR clients, the training styles and expectations are also based on that. But it is a very much imbalanced system and leads to a great deal of frustration, not only for end users, but for us that do the training as well.
What I hear from people, even when they've gone through training programs, are I went through a training program and they taught me a little bit about so-and-so and such, but they didn't really teach me to use it, and I don't feel like I've been adequately trained. Is that an issue of subjective perception on their part as it applies to agencies, or do you think that their position really does have merit?
There are such variety and quality, variety in how much time is granted to accomplish this, different models for providing it. All of which affect the outcome. One of the other problems is that learning is not something that you do, I'm going to take this class and when I'm done I'm going to be an expert at it. You have to apply what you've been taught in order for you to really develop independent skill in doing that task. You come to a trainer and say, I'd like to learn how to use PowerPoint. And so they walk you through the different menus and dialog boxes and processes for creating a PowerPoint presentation. But unless you use PowerPoint on a regular basis, your knowledge of that is going to decay. This is one of the reasons why I am so adamant that we accept nobody into training that doesn't have the product available the day after they leave training. So I say, to some degree, it's perceptual. To some degree, it's varying quality and quantity of the service being provided. But I also think that there is a false expectation that training is something you get and when you are done, you are ready. Training, as with any kind of learning, is a lifetime experience. And we really need to get into a situation where we get a bit of training now, a bit of training later, a bit of training later on an as-needed basis. And also get training in tasks and skills and the like as they have practical value for you. For somebody to come and get training in Excel spreadsheets and then go out looking for work when there's an expectation it may take a year or more for them to find employment, it just makes so much more sense for them to get a survey kind of course. What is a spreadsheet? What are cells? Some very basic stuff that they can retain and not focus so much on skills they can walk out of the training having mastered. Unless they use it, they're going to lose it.
Let me ask you one other question. One of the things that the Carroll Center has done is to introduce online training, and that suggests to me that you guys think that it actually has some value. Tell us a little bit why you think online training is a good thing, and what makes it good, and perhaps as well, if you would, talk about some of the problems that might be associated with it.
First, I'm going to tell you why we did it. We were going merrily along doing what we were currently doing, that is a standard face-to-face training, whether that training was at our training center on our campus in Newton outside of Boston, Massachusetts, or at people's homes and offices and schools. In the course of a year, we would typically, with our staff of 3 full-time and 2 part-time instructors, be able to train on an average 2 weeks or about 50 hours of training per individual for a total of about 250 individuals. Of those, more than 75 of them were professionals in the field of blindness, rehab teachers, rehab counselors, teachers of the visually impaired. So in terms of getting to actual blind and visually impaired individuals, we were reaching about 150 to 175 individuals. In Massachusetts alone, there are 36,000 blind people. It doesn't take much math to realize that each year we fell farther and farther behind in meeting the needs of individuals, while we expect that, in fact, more and more individuals want to and, in fact, would benefit from access to technology through both combination of the hardware and software and the training in how to use it. We don't like losing the battle year after year after year. So we looked at how other entities were dealing with their particular battles. And we saw that colleges and universities and businesses as well, who have a constant need for retraining, were finding that that model, the face-to-face model, simply wasn't working for them. So they looked at online. So we took a look at the products that they were using to accomplish that. Its pluses, its minuses. We read a number of books. Constantly read newsletters in the field of training, and we came to the conclusion that there was some value to it. But the value would have to be, one, in making training available at any time. An individual wouldn't have to dedicate 1 or 2 consecutive weeks full time to get training if that didn't fit into their other responsibilities, such as child rearing and work and medical issues. It's hard to go to a everyday, all-day class if you're also on kidney dialysis. So we wanted to break it free of the constant need to schedule and fill the schedule. Secondly, we wanted to make it so that it wasn't geographically sensitive. Part of the problem of offering any course other than a generic course is that doing one-on-one training is a financial losing proposition. Currently, for example, in Massachusetts, and we get paid the same amount by every state we do business with, we get about $1,500 of pay for what actually costs us $2,400. And we have to raise the difference through fundraising. That's simply what the states are willing to pay per week for that service. Part of that may be driven by competition, but more it's a matter of year after year flat budgets. While our costs have been going up, our fees have not been going up. So from a business model perspective, we needed to get away from this idea that we can only provide intermediate and advanced training on a one-on-one basis. While we could provide beginner training on a small group basis, if we're lucky enough to get individuals who have the same basic need and same basic background to agree to come to a single location to do training. So we decided that distance learning was the way to do that. We watched how other entities were doing it, some colleges and universities and the software that they use to accomplish that, also some private trainers and some state and public both private and public agencies who were dabbling on the edges of the concept of distance learning. And we came up with a model that we call Carroll Tech, available at carrolltech.org, carrollteche.org, where we provide a course which is equivalent of a 1 week face-to-face class in terms of its content and the hours it takes to complete it, from 25 to 36 hours, depending on how you're participating in the class. Classes are provided in either of two ways. That is self-paced, where you can do all the lessons in 1 week if you want, or you can spread them out over a course of 12 weeks. Your interaction with your instructor is solely on the basis of email. Or you can have an instructor-led course where we use a combination of the same web-based text, videos, exercises, and quizzes, along with audio chat sessions similar to this one, where at a specific time and on a specific day, the instructor agrees to be in an audio chat room, and all the students are welcome to come and ask their questions orally rather than attempting to write them up in any fashion that would make sense in an email. Also, it gives them the opportunity to interact not only with their instructor, but with fellow class members who may bring a different perspective to a particular thing that a student's having difficulty with. So we think that it has serious value. We've demonstrated that in our first 2 years. We have 750 members of the website. We have 275 individuals who have passed the qualifying quiz out of those individuals. Because before you take an online course, we really want you to have the necessary computer skills to access content online. That's email, web browsing, and a little bit of word processing, and a little bit of file management. And of those individuals, 220 actually took a course, and more than two-thirds of them have taken more than one course. So up to this point, the last statistic I saw, which was yesterday, indicated that the average score went from the mid-40s to the mid-80s after completing one of these courses. So I guess in terms of a measurable outcome, up to this point, they have been quite successful.
I think that we've certainly laid a framework. I think you'd probably agree that we have a long way to go. But let's see whether others have some questions or some comments on what we know right now. Perhaps even some suggestions for you. So, ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open.
Hey, Brian. Joe from Massachusetts. Now, my question is in several parts. One, what do people do that don't have a lot of money and who want to get training and who just want to learn a few things about computers? Don't you think that there has to be standards set?
Well, one is, as with any purchase of product or service, it's always buyer beware. Just because somebody says they're a trainer, that is not necessarily your definition of what they're capable of doing. So ask a few questions. Where did you get training to do what you do? Where have you done it before? Give me the name of two or three individuals or organizations you've done training for before I put my money on the line and say, I'd like you to be my trainer. Even if you are going to have the service provided to you by purchase by a state agency, you have consumer choice. If you are unhappy with how a given entity or individual is providing you this service, or you would prefer it some way else, there is consumer choice built into the Rehab Act, and you can demand that. The cost of things, I have to tell you, if you're getting computer training for $75 an hour, I know computer trainers that are charging two and three times that figure. And they are still being paid significantly less to train blind and visually impaired people how to do these things than if they were training a more popular product to the mainstream. So while it's expensive to an individual who's on a fixed income, the fact is it is cheap compared to what the mainstream would charge for the same activity. So how do you get around that money issue? There's really only two or three options. One is that you put a lot of pressure on the local not-for-profits to provide some form of scholarship toward the services they provide in terms of access technology training. Two, you try to get the libraries, and there's a lot of public libraries out there who have access training sitting in their libraries and would kill to get you to come in to use it, to go in there, take a look at it, say you'd love to use it, but you really need a little bit of training on how to use it, and see about getting their folks who are involved in IT in those libraries to be a little more educated on how to do this, and also to buy up and make available some of the recorded tutorials that are available on cassette and CD for this kind of training.
Brian, I have a question regarding the evaluation process. This is Charlie from Central New York. I can understand that, at least from categorically, that once it's determined the degree of sight, hearing, ability to learn Braille, etc., that one has, determines whether speech will be used, such as JAWS or Winder Eyes, or the OCR package might be used, or a combination of Braille and the above might be used. But when one evaluates an individual and gets into choosing whether or not JAWS will be used over Window Eyes or Open Book will be used over over Kurzweil, how is that choice really made? Or is it not just a choice of Chevy versus Ford, just a personal preference? The product seems so comparable in their features and what the end results of them will be, namely JAWS gives you very much the same kind of output as Window Eyes. Kurzweil gives you the same kind of end result as Open Book. So, you know, is it not just a matter of personal choice, or is there something that is really applicable between the student and that particular product or any particular product?
Good question. First off, keeping in mind that the vast majority of adaptive technology is not purchased by the person, it's purchased by some entity on the person's behalf. So since you want to get your product now, they don't buy it, as most states do not buy it, as it's determined that that's what you should have. They're taking a look on the closet shelf to determine what they have available. They also know that to some degree they're going to have to provide technical support for that product, because when something like that doesn't work properly, somebody has to be able to go out and answer it, and it has to be their priority to answer those questions and solve those problems now. So states, entities that issue multiple copies of screen readers in a given year tend to standardize on one and only use the other when the one is inappropriate. For example, if you need to use Citrix, there is no issue. You should be using Window Eyes because it handles it as well. Of course, there's always this constant, you know, catch up between the leaders in the field, and now JAWS can provide access to that as well. But at the time, there was a significant amount of time where only Window Eyes could do that. Therefore, you'd be using Window Eyes. On the other hand, how JAWS works with other products, let's say, for example, Lotus Notes, I would say that there's a real strong push toward JAWS in that environment. The same thing can be said for screen magnifiers, for OCR products, for PDAs and note takers. Each one of them performs basically the same function as its competitor for 70 to 80% of what they do. But there's that unique 20% part, some of which is actual in it can do it or it can't do it kind of features, and some it can do it easily or it can only do it through a complex process kind of feature. And again, that's where decisions are made, sometimes by professionals who have evaluated the workplace or school and determined which product works for it. Sometimes they're simply following the lead because it's the path of least resistance. And sometimes they're following the lead of the end user who voiced an extreme concern about using one product versus another. And sometimes they come back to regret those kind of decisions.
Hi, this is Kristen Main here, by the way. I think for this training, I just think it's comment to make on this. It's really good. I mean, you know, people to have it. You know, if they really want to learn these skills, I just think it's best that they, you know, go about doing it. Otherwise, you're just not going to have what you need, you know. And so that's what I feel should happen. And if people want to do it, then I would say go for it.
Another question for Brian. And thanks very much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Hey, Joe from Boston. Does the Carroll Center have a setup where people who don't have money can get the training or to try different screen readers? I know there's a new one out there, $100 or $100-and-some-dollars Outlook. As you and I know that these are very expensive, and what you said at the beginning, is there a way that they can try different things out until eventually everything gets standardized someday and is not a ton of money? They go in and try, work with you people to see which is best for them, because undoubtedly they've got to learn about Windows and Windows problems. Someone will may have to help them reinstall Windows. People like me who live alone. That's why I asked this.
On Friday afternoons, by appointment from 3 to 5 p.m., it can be arranged free of charge for anybody to come to the Carroll Center and give us a little notice what it is you want. Maybe you want to try side-by-side screen readers or screen magnifiers or CCTVs, scanners, braille embossers, whatever they may be. And one of our instructors will be assigned to you for that two-hour period to take a look at the pluses and minuses of the different devices. It doesn't have to be a comparison. Maybe you're saying, I've decided I want to get JAWS, but I really need to see it shown to me by somebody other than a salesman. And again, that's what that Fridays from 3 to 5 by appointment can be done. You can call the Carroll Center at Massachusetts area code 617-969-6200 and ask to speak with Dina Rosenbaum, and she'll set up the appointment. That's one thing that we are doing to try to keep the price down. Again, if an individual is paying for their training, then we will negotiate a fee for that, keeping in mind that we're already making up a difference of about $900 a week per person for the current cost versus what the state pays us. We'll still bring it down a bit farther for end users if they're willing to say that they don't have the funding to pay for it entirely themselves. Lastly, the Carroll Tech classes I was talking about before, I said that we were interested in doing that in order to make training available at any time from anywhere. But we also wanted to do that to drive the cost down. So currently, if a state agency pays for an individual to take a Carroll Tech class, it's that same $1,500 to take that course. The state will pay for it because it still doesn't even cover the cost of doing it online. If an individual signs up for that same class, the tuition for 1 week's worth of training, that's 25 hours, somewhere between 25 and 36 hours, depending on how you go about doing the learning, is $100.
Thank you, Brian.
A final question for Brian.
Hi, this is Chris in Maine again. Comment and a question. I think that online trading is good. You know, say if, like for me, for instance, if I hear about a class on email from somebody that sends it to me that I know, and then I say I decide I want to sign up for the class and take it online, the nice thing is that you don't have to leave your home or office. You know, you just can take it in your home and, you know, do it the same way, except, you know, do it at your home, at your convenience. And my question is, and that's my comment, my question is, do they offer these online classes every day for the weekdays? I know some places offer it, oh, say 5 days a week. I just throw that in there as a question. So, just wondering. Thank you.
Thank you. The answer is that when you sign up for a Carroll Tech course, you have 12 weeks to complete 12 lessons. This is typical. There are exceptions. Some have fewer lessons, some have more, but you get the general idea that it's about one lesson a week if you pace it out over the whole period of time that you have access to the content. You could choose to do lesson one and two on Monday and three and four on Tuesday and do it at that pace if you would like. It tends not to be as effective as spreading it out and doing a little practice from time to time between the work that you actually do on the lessons. We used to do 2 lessons a week in our audio chat format. However, we found that by the time we got to about week 4, where you should have been through lesson 8, half of the people were a lesson or two behind. So we spread them out so that those live sessions now are once a week. We attempt to move the time and day of those around depending on which time each quarter we provide it. So we might do Introduction to Excel with JAWS on Tuesday's audio chat session at 3 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern, one quarter, and then on Wednesday at 4, another quarter, and Friday at 1 in another quarter to mix it up a little bit. They tend to be in the afternoon because we want to draw students from all over the country. And if we offered a class at 9 a.m., that means the West Coasters would have to sign in at 6 in the morning. So they tend to be in the afternoon. They also tend to end by no later than 6 p.m. Eastern because I'm doing the instruction using my existing instructors, and they've been at work a long time by the time 6 p.m. rolls around.
We've talked about access technology training tonight and have explored a broad range of options that are available. We've discovered that it isn't necessarily a finished product, that in fact it evolves all the time. We've established that there are issues that surround it that relate to where it should be delivered and how it should be delivered. It's an evolving element too. We've gone from a place where tape tutorials dominated things 10 years ago to a place where online tutorials are becoming more and more important and various kinds of online training are becoming more and more common. There's still an awful lot, I think, that we could say about access technology training, but I hope that what everybody goes away with tonight is a recognition that access technology training is something that ought to be everyone's concern, because unless we are effective and competent users of access technology, the chances are that we will not be employable 5 to 10 years from now. I'd like to thank Brian Charlson very much for being here. I'd like to thank all of those who participated with comments and questions, and I'd like particularly to thank all of you who listened in on ACB Radio. We appreciate your attention and your time. Good night. Join us again next week on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.